This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it.
And to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government.
The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them.
He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only.
He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures.
He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing, with manly firmness, his invasions on the rights of the people.
He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within.
He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power.
He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states.
For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury.
For transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments. For suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever.
He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation.
He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury.
A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us.
We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence.
They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved.
And that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
232 years ago today, church bells rang over Philadelphia as the Continental Congress adopted Thomas Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence.
We now have a recipe for a savory snack, maybe even a last-minute addition to your 4th of July picnic. The ingredients might surprise you, unless you happen to live in the Aloha State. Here's NPR's Neva Grant.
Promise you'll try to keep an open mind when you hear these words, spam sushi.
Okay, here we are. Let's look for spam.
I'm with cookbook author Muriel Mura at a Honolulu grocery store. More spam per capita is sold in Hawaii than in any other state.
Wow, they have quite a variety here. Look at that. They have bacon spam, turkey spam, hot and spicy.
Mura is Japanese-American. She was a young girl in Honolulu when Pearl Harbor was bombed. In wartime, tons of spam were shipped here, shipped everywhere by the military.
Plastic, of course.
It was cheap, it kept well in the heat, and pretty soon, in Hawaii, it began to taste like home.
Definitely. It's the favorite meat source, I think, for most people in Hawaii now.
Mura's new cookbook basically blows the lid off spam, enshrines it in recipes from every corner of the world.
Like spam pancit, which is a Filipino dish, and we have pibium pab, which is a Korean version of spam rice, and we have spam taco salad.
Yes, lots of dishes imported from the mainland, including a hearty casserole of rice, garlic, and hot sauce called, what else? Spambalaya.
Okay, we're in the kitchen now. And we're going to roll some sushi. And so I have steamed rice that has been seasoned with vinegar and sugar.
She's making spam maki sushi, which is rolled in that flat, dry seaweed, nori. Think California roll.
So I just put the sushi rice to cover most of the area of the nori. Then you can put some mayonnaise.
Whoa, wait a minute. Mayonnaise? Yes, says Mura. People in Hawaii put mayo on everything.
And the Japanese like to have mayonnaise with their cucumbers.
Which is what she adds next to the sushi roll. Then spicy wasabi paste. And of course,
two strips of spam right across. Then you need to place your hands on the spam to hold it in place. And just roll away from you like you would jelly roll. And then just give it a nice squeeze.
And you have a fat caterpillar of nori with all the ingredients inside. After you slice it and before you eat it, you could say,
itadakimasu.
Which roughly means thank you for this meal in Japanese.
Would you like to taste the sushi with chopsticks? Of course, huh?
Can I take this whole big chunk?
Sure. Here you go.
And you know, the sushi roll is tasty.
It's great with green tea.
And whether you love spam or hate it, frankly, you can't really taste it in this robust mix of flavors. If you didn't know, you might think the spam was a chewy bit of avocado or maybe a very pink piece of egg. And if you feel like cleansing your palate afterwards, just as you would after eating raw fish, Muriel Mura says, go right ahead and have a pink slice of pickled ginger. That's what it's for.
The other thing you could do if you really like ginger is to put the ginger into the center right next to your spam.
And really, why not? Spam with ginger, mayonnaise on seaweed? We're Americans. Critics say we don't really live in a melting pot, but on the 4th of July, and on any day, really, we sure do eat out of one. Neva Grant, NPR News, Itadakimasu.
If you want it, the recipe for spam sushi is online at npr.org.
Ari?
Uh-huh.
Did that rotten apple really hurt?
No, just a little bit messy is all.
Well, okay, so we've survived the stale gingerbread and rotten apples that hurled our way as yesterday we questioned whether William Shakespeare from Stratford-upon-Avon could have written the works that bear his name. Seriously, a lot of scholars say it doesn't matter who the author is, but a major theme in Shakespeare's work is the question of identity and disguise.
So many of the plays hinge around someone believing that someone else is a friend when they're a foe, or a foe when they're a friend.
Actor Mark Rylance has played virtually every major role in Shakespeare.
Someone having an image of themselves which doesn't actually turn out to be who they are. Someone thinking that a young man is a young man and they're actually a young woman, or vice versa, in the Shakespeare plays. That it's very attractive to think that the author would also weave that kind of magic around his or her identity.
Rylance is among those who think it likely the author did disguise his true identity behind the name William Shakespeare. As the founding creative director of London's Globe Theatre, Mark Rylance collected and displayed material about other contenders. This morning, we hear the case for one man who many think is the real author. We begin in the courtyard of the Globe.
Edward de Vere was the 17th Earl of Oxford, and he was a great star at court in his early years.
Charles Beauclerc is a direct descendant of Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford. He recounts the many reasons his ancestor de Vere could have written the plays: a Cambridge education, fluency in French, Italian, Latin, and Greek, a broad knowledge of the law, jousting and other royal pastimes, an intimacy with the Queen's court, a reputation as a poet, plus...
He inherited an acting company from his father. And throughout his life, he always had at least one company, sometimes two. So the theatre was part of his life. He put on masks and plays at court.
Others during Queen Elizabeth's time had a similar resume. Oxford has been a favorite for more than 80 years because his own life intersects with the plays in a myriad of dramatic ways.
Take a map of Italy and take out 10 pushpins, and you put these pushpins in the following 10 cities: Venice, Padua, Milan, Genoa, Palermo, Florence, Siena, Naples, Verona, and Messina. That's essentially Shakespeare's Italy, right there.
And Shakespeare's Italy, argues author Mark Anderson, is Edward de Vere's Italy. In his biography of Oxford, titled Shakespeare by Another Name, Mark Anderson portrays a real life through which shines the many fictional lives in Shakespeare, starting with Italy. From Romeo and Juliet's Verona to The Merchant of Venice, half of Shakespeare's comedies and tragedies are set in Italy. It's a place William Shakespeare never went and where Edward de Vere traveled extensively.
Venice in particular is portrayed in The Merchant of Venice and Othello with such exquisite detail that could only come from someone who knows that city from firsthand experience. I mean, it goes from everything from ritualistic cultural curios. There's a character in Merchant of Venice who presents this dish of baked doves, and you see a production of Merchant of Venice, and people don't know what to do with it because it's just bizarre. Well, it turns out that in Venice at that time, a dish of baked doves was actually an honorific gift that you gave to someone as a token of your respect.
Another example can be found in The Taming of the Shrew. Daniel Wright directs the Authorship Research Center at Oregon's Concordia University.
We know that when Edward de Vere was in Venice, he borrowed 500 crowns from a man named Baptista Negroni. And when Oxford was in Padua, he borrowed more money from a man named Pasquino Spinola. Now, in Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, Kate's father is described as a man who is rich in crowns. Where does this character in Shakespeare's play live? In Padua. And what is his name? Baptista Minola, a conflation of Baptista Negroni and Pasquino Spinola.
But for author Mark Anderson, the single most compelling play linking Oxford to Shakespeare's work contains this famous line.
The play is the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king.
Here, Kenneth Branagh plays Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark. Turns out Edward de Vere's brother-in-law was an emissary to Denmark, and he wrote de Vere private letters about his experiences.
And he talks about these drinking rituals of downing a shot and then shooting off the cannons, and that, of course, is preserved in Hamlet. De Vere's brother-in-law writes about this banquet that he attends with these courtiers named Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And again, all this stuff, it's unpublished. It would be table talk with de Vere and his brother-in-law. It was essentially unavailable to anyone else.
There's also the matter of the character Polonius. He was the father of Ophelia, whom Hamlet spurned. And it was de Vere's own father-in-law, who many traditional scholars say was the model for Polonius.
Polonius is this kind of busybody, meddlesome spymaster in the Danish court. This is exactly the central relationship of de Vere's life. De Vere was married to a young woman whose father was the Lord Treasurer, spymaster, busybody supreme of Elizabethan England.
The evidence that Edward de Vere wrote Shakespeare is, of course, entirely circumstantial. But there are scores of such connections, and the case is intriguing enough that in 1987, three sitting Supreme Court justices agreed to hear what became a famous moot court debate, Earl of Oxford versus William Shakespeare. In the following videotape, the attorney for Shakespeare expresses skepticism to Justice John Paul Stevens that a nobleman like Oxford would find it beneath him to sign his name to the plays.
The main Oxfordian argument, the one on which my learned friend relied, is that it was a matter of great shame to be revealed as the author of literary works.
For me to at least raise the question whether the Queen, who did a number of things that are difficult to explain, she was a person with certain idiosyncrasies and fond of secrecy, and well, but perhaps if the monarch said, I don't want your authorship known, that would be the end of it as far as what de Vere might do.
I would be the last to deny the idiosyncrasies of monarchy.
Back at the Globe Theatre, Charles Beauclerc says that had his ancestor, de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, put his name on the plays, it would have been no laughing matter. The tragedies and comedies contained exposés of some of the court's most powerful, ruthless, and deadly people.
He wouldn't have survived 10 minutes because of the satirical and political content of the plays. He needed to mask that in some way. whether through a pen name or through a pen name and a front man, which is clearly what he used.
Now back to that 1987 moot court. The justices did find for William Shakespeare, but later all three came to doubt their decision. A few years ago, Justice John Paul Stevens told the New York Times that if he had to choose today, quote, I'd say it definitely was Oxford. And Ari, since neither the Earl of Oxford nor the gentleman from Stratford left behind a handwritten or signed copy of any of the works of Shakespeare, this debate could go on forever and a day. But you and I must now take our leave.
Yes, and ask our listeners, as you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set us free.
Hope you're enjoying your breakfast this holiday morning. If it happens to be pancakes, give a thought to Bill Gates. Today he's settling into life after Microsoft. But in his life before Microsoft took off, a much younger Bill Gates spent some time thinking about pancakes, an untidy stack of pancakes. He even published a mathematics paper about it. And academics say it was a fine piece of work. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports from the Lincoln Waffle Shop in Washington, D.C.
I need a stack of pancakes.
Okay. Would you like butter?
Sure. I need a big stack of pancakes.
Sure, thank you. I got you.
All right, so the problem Bill Gates was trying to solve was this. Imagine you work at a diner, and the cook is really fast, but he's not the most organized guy, and when he piles up the pancakes, sometimes the biggest pancake is on top and the smallest one's in the middle, and it's just a mess. So your job is to sort them using a spatula. And you can only put the spatula in someplace in the stack and just flip the pancakes above you. You have to figure out a series of flips that will sort the stack so that you get the biggest pancake on the bottom, the second biggest one above that, all the way up to the smallest one on top so that you can present it to the customer in a nice pile. It turns out to be a very difficult math problem.
The question is, if there are n pancakes, where n is 73 pancakes or 12 pancakes or whatever, what's the minimum number of flips that suffice always to sort the stack?
Harry Lewis is a professor at Harvard University, and back in the 1970s, he gave this puzzle to his combinatorial mathematics class, just as an example of a problem that was easy to describe but had not been solved.
So I posed it in class, and then I went on, and a day or two later, as I recall, this smart sophomore comes into my office and explains that he's got a five-thirds N algorithm.
The student with the five-thirds N algorithm was Bill Gates. So what does five-thirds N mean? Well, there's a fairly simple way to sort the stack, but it would require two flips per pancake, 2N. Basically, you start by sticking the spatula under the biggest pancake, flip it and the stack above it, which puts the biggest one on top. Then you flip the whole stack, putting the biggest pancake where you want it, on the bottom. Then you repeat this for the second largest one, etc. Anyway, Gates had a better procedure. Instead of requiring two flips per pancake in the stack, it required five-thirds, or 1.67 flips.
And it involved a complicated case analysis of what exactly the configuration of the top few pancakes might look like and so on. It was quite clever.
Bill Gates worked on it with a young assistant professor at Harvard, and in 1979, the research got published under the title Bounds for Sorting by Prefix Reversal.
I think the problem remained pretty much in that state for 30 years, and then just recently,
some researchers found a slightly better sorting strategy, but it's only 1% faster. And they figured it out only with the help of powerful computers.
I have to look at this paper and laugh. You know, they never could have actually done the case analysis were it not for the computer industry that Bill Gates built in the intervening 30 years.
Lewis looks back on this story with pleasure. It was a brush with a kid who would shape history, even if it wasn't in the lofty realm of mathematics.
We, who've spent our careers in academia and consider this the highest calling known to humankind, will say, you know, that this really proves that Bill could have done something important and noble with his life. That's a joke. I do believe that he's done something enormously important and increasingly noble. But yes, you know, if he'd wanted to, he could have been a mathematician. Thank goodness he didn't choose that path.
Lewis won't say what grade Bill Gates got in his class, but he says Gates did well. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
We heard yesterday from the Welsh soul singer Duffy. She's one in a new crop of British women singer-songwriters. Today, 18-year-old Laura Marling. She came into our New York studios and told me she understands that people will lump her in with other contemporary female British singers, but she says they're a gender, not a genre.
It's not an insult, but it's it's strange because we come from completely different places. The only thing we have in common is that we're female.
It seems as though in some ways you've sort of tried to resist the image-based, mainstream commercial success that many other musicians strive for. How do you approach your career in that sense?
I just think of everything I do in how happy it will make me to do it. I don't like having my photograph taken, for instance, so I don't do that often, and I play guitar and sing, and that's my thing. I'm not much of a talker. So if there's a chance for me to play my guitar and sing, I'm there.
Do you have your guitar there? You want to play something for us?
Yeah, sure. This is called Cross Your Fingers. Look down on the body that you have grown. For mountains stand around you, they're not your own. And light squares and bodies are all you see. Since you broke down, since I broke down, since we broke down, I jump into your grave and die.
What's that meeting like where you tell Virgin Records, actually, no, I'm not going to have my photo on the album jacket?
If they ever tried to make me do anything like that, I would down tools.
Is that a British expression? I'm not familiar with it.
Down tools. Stop working. I've put the guitar down. The music industry is whatever you want it to be. If you want to be mega famous, you're going to have to do things that people tell you until you get mega famous, and then you can tell everybody what to do.
As you've gotten bigger, have there been moments that people have said, no, we need you to do this, and you've said, that's just not going to happen?
Yeah, of course, of course. And you just have to stay in control. And I've got... I think I'm lucky because my dad ran a studio when we were growing up and ran a recording studio, so I knew a bit about, you know, I've always had a bit of sort of know-how about it. So I'm bloody lucky, really. And I stay in control because it is my career, it's just sort of common sense, really. Are you crawl out of the sea, stayed into my arms, stayed into my arms.
I understand when you started your national tour about a year and a half ago, there was a concert that you were actually not allowed to play because you weren't old enough. Will you tell me that story?
It was my first UK tour. And we'd all been travelling around the country in this, you know, rubbish old van. And then we got to London and we went in, we sound checked. I was in the dressing room and the manager of the club came in and said, do you have any ID? And I said, no. He said that his bouncer had read in the paper that I was playing here tonight and that I was 17. And the reason that it was such a big deal, they usually don't really care in England, but it was because it was a gay strip club. And they had a strip license, so I couldn't go in.
But a crowd had formed to hear you.
So my band, I was obviously really upset because we'd sold out the gig. I mean, it was only 200 capacity. And my band just marched outside, and we played on the street outside two sex shops in Soho. It was really fun. I was running off adrenaline from that gig for like weeks after.
Your performance style has been described as stare intensely at a spot on the floor. How do you feel about performing for people?
I love it. I used to get horrendously nervous. I didn't love it when I was a nipper.
The 18-year-old says.
Yeah. But I've grown to love it. It's like an exciting fear.
What's it a fear of?
Playing in front of a room full of people.
Well, will you play something else for us, given that we're in an intimate little studio with a mere handful of people?
This is called The Last I Cannot Swim. There's a house across the river, but alas, I cannot swim. And a garden of such beauty that the flowers seem to grin. There's a house across the river, but alas, I cannot swim. I live my life regretting that I never jumped in. It's a certain amount of fantasy. There being this particular formula for living and for having a real life that I haven't done because I left school, I didn't go to university, I didn't enjoy school at all, but I loved literature and I loved music and that's what I knew I loved. But because I didn't take the exams, you know, I think it's basically my insecurity about not having finished my school years. There's a life across the river that was meant for me. Instead, I live my life in constant misery. There's a life across the river, but I do not see why I should please those who will never be pleased. You know, you are what you can prove you've done. That's how people judge you. You know, I've released an album, so I can prove to people that I was a songwriter. And people who've finished university can prove to people that they've got a degree and they've worked for something. And I think, like, I love so many things, but I haven't got any qualifications. You know, apart from the album is my qualification, I guess. There is gold across the river, but I don't want none. I would rather be dry than held up by a golden gun. Saying work more, earn more, live more, have more fun. Saying work more, earn more, live more, have more fun. Sing, work more, earn more, live more, have more fun.
That's Laura Marling playing Alas, I Cannot Swim, the title track from her new album, and it's a hidden track on the album.
Yeah. You gave the game away there.
Oh, I'm sorry. And you can hear more of Laura Marling's songs at the music section of NPR.org.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Steve Inskeep is back on Monday. And Renee, it's been a pleasure hosting with you these last couple of weeks.
And it's been a pleasure having you sort of next to me, 3,000 miles away, in the host chair there in D.C.
Forgive me, I am only a man. But I can see a babe.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand. Coming up, how the uninsured get better health care in Germany. First, you probably watch videos on YouTube. Well, your personal information, your username, and your computer address could be handed over to Viacom as part of its lawsuit against Google. Google owns YouTube, and that was a federal judge's order this week. Viacom claims a lot of its copyrighted material, shows like The Colbert Report, a lot of them are illegally posted on YouTube. I wanted to find out why Viacom would want everyone's information as opposed to just that of the people illegally uploading. And so I phoned Jennifer Urban. She runs the Intellectual Property and Technology Law Clinic at USC here in Los Angeles. She says as part of its lawsuit, Viacom wants to determine how many people watch its videos on YouTube and when they watch them.
So from what I gather from the judge's order, Viacom doesn't want to just know how many times the videos have been viewed, but the time period during which they were being viewed, so they want to understand that time frame. It's puzzling to me why they would also need the login ID and the IP address for that purpose.
So aside from privacy concerns, are there any concerns that Viacom could then go after people, like the record industry did, go after people for downloading videos illegally?
Well, in other news reports, Viacom has been quoted as saying that it will not go after individual infringers. However, if this becomes a precedent, then other litigants may not refrain in the way Viacom has said it will.
You know, privacy experts such as yourself, they say they're shocked at this ruling and that it'll remind people just how much personal information a huge company like Google has. Well, how much information does it have?
Google has information about every person who's logged in, every time they viewed a video, what videos they viewed, and it's all tied back to their username. It has all of the search terms that people have used to find videos tied back to their username and the IP address of the computer they were using. And it's hard to say, you know, how much information they actually have on their servers. And, you know, Google is, of course, not at all the only company that has this kind of information recorded. Many, many internet media companies have this kind of information about users.
So this is really a reminder that
nothing that you do online is strictly private.
Almost everything you do online requires you to leave tracks that can be tracked back to you.
Let's say Google does comply with the judge's order as written and turns over these IP addresses. There must be millions or maybe billions of them, right? I mean, how can you actually turn over all these addresses, and how does Viacom go through all that information?
Yes, well, the judge's order says that this database alone, which is the three pieces of information I mentioned, is 12 terabytes. That's a huge amount of data. It's going to cost a lot for Google to produce it. It would cost a tremendous amount for Viacom to go through it, as you said. This is a massive discovery request.
So is this it, or will they come up with a different solution, the two sides?
The two sides have both discussed somehow anonymizing the information, and I don't know more beyond that. Yesterday, apparently, Google did ask the judge to reconsider the order. The judge dismissed Google's argument that this information fell under the Video Privacy Protection Act. There's actually a law that governs when data about a user's records related to video rentals or similar kinds of audiovisual material can be turned over. That law was passed in response to a situation in 1989 when Judge Bork was up as a Supreme Court nominee and his video rental records were disclosed. That obviously caused kind of a kerfuffle at the time, and the Video Privacy Protection Act was passed in response to protect exactly this kind of information, because we understand that the kind of information that comes from what people choose to view, what information they are accessing, what questions they're trying to answer, is just deeply personal, and it's fundamental to the freedom of inquiry that we value here. Now, the judge dismissed the Video Privacy Protection Act defense that Google put forth, and it's a little bit unclear exactly why. It may be because the judge thought that usernames and IP addresses were not sufficiently personally identifiable information to be covered by the act. I think that that is unlikely to be the case and that it should apply.
Jennifer Urban is the director of the Intellectual Property and Technology Law Clinic at USC, and we've been talking about a judge's order to Google to turn over all its records linking users to every video that they've watched on YouTube. Jennifer Urban, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you.